The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
5 years since its founding, Enthu is hoping to increase its seat representation in the Dáil from its current single seat. Now, to help this, the party has launched their Common Sense Manifesto, that's what they call it, and they ask people to imagine what they could accomplish with a team of TDs. Now, to talk about more than just what they want to accomplish, their manifesto indeed, we're joined in studio by the Enthu leader and their single outgoing TD, Patha Tobin. Patha, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, your manifesto, we want to look at points of difference because there's a lot of commonality in terms of what the various parties are promising. You have something you called Operation Shamrock.
Yes.
Explain that. What is it?
So basically, we have currently significant recruitment and retention issues in the Irish public services and in construction at the moment. Shockingly, we have hundreds of thousands of Irish people building houses, but a lot of them are actually in Canada and in Australia. And this Christmas, many families will have an empty chair because their loved one is raising a family in those countries. So what we're looking to do is make sure that those individuals have a future in this country. One of the things we want to do is entice them back to Ireland in terms of a grant for transport and accommodation, €5,000, and also a tax break for 4 years if they remain within the particular business that they're in. And also at the end as well, to build houses specifically for those professions on the basis of exemptions that already exist in planning for housing for those individuals.
These are Class 17 exemptions. The idea here would be you have a whole pile of builders you need to build maybe 600 houses, and they come back from Canada, New Zealand, wherever they are, and you basically put up mobile homes.
Yeah, you could build temporary accommodation. You could build modular homes.
But the idea is they would have to be removed under Class 17.
Under the current system. But like, I do think we actually should be talking about, can we do this in the longer term as well? Because like we have the government obviously building modular homes in terms of IPAS and people coming here from Ukraine. And they have accepted that in an emergency situation, that sometimes exemptions are necessary to get these homes built. Now, obviously, the government has spent twice the amount of money in those modular homes than it actually would have cost to build a brick.
But just think about it. You're inviting a builder and his or her family to come home, whatever technical skill they have, and they're living in a comfortable semi-D in the suburbs of Melbourne or Sydney. And you want them to go home and live in a mobile home?
Well, we don't want them to live in a mobile home. We want to build decent modular homes in terms of that that exemption. But we do want to stretch that exemption for the building of homes in general for those professions. Because here's the deal, Pat. Like, we have 900,000 people on hospital waiting lists. We have thousands of vacancies in our education system. Many of those doctors, nurses, teachers, Gardaí currently can't afford to live in the Greater Dublin area anyways. You know, they're actually leaving the country for better terms and conditions and the chance of owning a home. And we have to treat this as an emergency, both in terms of the provision of homes and the provision of those public services. Like, incredibly, last year, net, Australia employed more Gardaí than the Irish state did. And, you know, that's an incredible situation. So we need to realise that these...
Okay. How would people qualify for the €5,000 voucher? And why wouldn't they just come home, have a great holiday here and go back, having got the voucher?
Well, first of all, we would build into the small print in relation to that, that they have responsibility to stay here for the 4 years within the specific profession that they're working in. So we're not talking about people who've just tipped over for a year or on the way back. These are people who we are sure of that this is a decision that is being made on the basis of the availability of this grant.
Now, I want to move on another point of difference. You want the state to purchase the toll bridges and the toll roads.
Yeah, I think that the M50 especially is a monument to government waste. And what I mean by that is they were built for £53 million way back in the day. The government has already spent about €1.3 billion on those tolls in relation to the initial purchases, etc. And we have to, at this stage, realise that the punter has paid for the M50 tolls at this stage. And, you know, there's absolutely no argument for those tolls to be increased. And actually, we believe that those tolls should be got rid of at this moment in time.
These things are done with private relationships.
The PPPs.
And in order to buy them out, you have to buy out the contracts, which would be, in many cases, 30-year contracts.
Yeah, so we're
so you have to pay them off for all of that.
But the M50 is not under PPP. The M50 is fully under our ownership. The state actually owns that. It's a cash cow, Pat, in reality, for the state. And more than that, there has been a policy, I think, by Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and especially the Greens, to really punish drivers in recent times. They say that it's there to get people to use alternative public transport. But for most people, alternative public transport is not there. So, you know, they're using the stick rather than the carrots.
Okay, in you're terms in government, say, and you say there's 1.3 billion that is a cash cow for the government. How do you replace that?
Well, first of all, you're talking about the M50 toll itself brings in about 180 million euros a year in its own right. But last year, the government took in 3.8 billion euros in fuel taxes, the highest ever in the history of the state. So we're not shy in terms of fuel taxes. We pay fuel taxes and our road tax for the roads. But what we're doing is we're getting fleeced, Pat, here in relation to this. And all I'm saying is that the government, if they want to nudge people out of the car, nudge them when there is a bus available for them, when there is a rail line available for them, trying to nudge them out of their car with financial penalties such as this, when there isn't an alternative, is punitive.
But is the idea of buying all of these PPPs up for the remainder of the 30 years, whatever's left? I mean, we did a back of the envelope calculation; could be 2 billion.
Well, we're looking first and foremost for the tolls that are in state ownership. So you have the likes of the East Link, you have the M50, and they actually take the majority of tolls paid in this country are actually paid by those two bridges. This is the busiest road in the country, the M50.
So, and DCC would probably say, listen, we need the money. If we lose that money,
listen, I do understand that this money is used. First of all, I want to say as well, we're actually spending about millions of euros a year on the private company that is now putting up the technology to collect the toll currently. So a big chunk of the toll that's collected in the M50 is going just on the functioning of the collection of the toll there. The M50, without a shadow of a doubt, is ours. We've paid for it 10, 15 times over. We owe nothing to any PPP. At this stage, there's no excuse for an increase in tolls, and in reality, we should be actually looking to get rid of that toll.
And there are arguments anyway about whether people who have to cross the toll bridge using the M50 are paying for the other people who never have to cross the toll bridge.
Well, you look at it for like a case in point in people in Meath, right? So if you're from Kells in Meath, you will have to travel through 3 tolls in one direction if you're working in South Dublin and back. You could pay up to 4 grand a year in terms of tolls. And, you know, there's about 70,000 to 80,000 people in my county commuting out of the county on a daily basis, crying out for a rail line that the government have refused to deliver. And, you know, I think it's a cheek for the government to demand 4.5 grand of tolls from commuters when they won't provide the alternative for people.
Now, something else that is a standout from your Common Sense Manifesto is an Irish Sea border to keep people out. Now, you've got two jurisdictions. Well, you've got kind of a number. You've got the UK jurisdiction based in London. You've got the Belfast jurisdiction, which is the power-sharing government, and you've got the jurisdiction in Dublin. How would all of them get together and square that circle?
Okay, so the reason why we've decided for an Irish Sea border, that this Irish Sea border would allow Irish citizens and British citizens travel amongst these islands in exactly the same manner that they're travelling at the moment. So there'd be no change for people. The reason why we came up with the idea is because we do have a crisis in terms of migration at the moment. And the government is asleep at the wheel in terms of just implementing the law. I put in a rake of parliamentary questions to the Minister for Justice. She tells me there are no exit checks in this country, because they cannot provide exit checks because we have a border with the north of Ireland. So when she tells people that she has given 1,750 deportation orders this year, only 98 of those are enforced. Only 98 can we confirm have actually left. And that's an incredible mess.
We don't know whether the others have left or not.
We don't, exactly. So in other words,
and cannot know.
So we cannot know because there's no exit checks. And when I ask her, why are there no exit checks? Because she said we have an open border with, she calls it the UK. So the only solution to that is actually to have an Irish Sea border. And all we're saying is that if a person's coming from Birmingham or Edinburgh or Bristol into Ireland, north or south, they show their passport on the way in. And if they're applying for asylum, they apply for asylum on the island of Ireland, wherever they're landing. We've already come to that understanding in terms of goods because of Brexit. There is now an Irish Sea border for goods. You know, everybody came to the realisation that we can't police the border between north and south. It's impossible. If we're going to control it, we should control it at the ports on the island of Ireland. If we've accepted it for the logic of goods. The same is the case for the logic of people.
Logic is one thing, but the DUP is something else.
It is, and people said you could never get an IRC border for goods because of the DUP, but we did, and that's the truth. And you know, one of my biggest frustrations is this, is that the government are poo-pooing this without even asking the British, or even discussing with them. It's in their interest, Pat, and I'll tell you why.
Because why would it be? They're delighted to get rid of the migrants that they don't want.
If you look after the last 15 years, the flows go both directions, depending on the economies and depending on the international circumstances. So there have been regularly situations where London has complained that people are landing in Dublin, you know, driving up to Belfast and getting a flight into London. So it is in their interest.
So you're
as
saying
well.
There would be passport checks on the IRC, basically.
Well, they're already in practice. Like if you're flying from London to Derry, you have to show your passport. It's not in the law that you have to show your passport, but the airlines enforce it anyway. So there'd be no practical change for any citizen of these two islands.
But, yeah, I know. But the principle there for the airlines is that they need to know that you are who you say you are for terrorism reasons and all sorts of reasons when get on the plane. They need to know who you are. On the other hand, on the political front, the idea of a citizen of the United Kingdom, a member of the Ulster Unionist Party or the DUP, being asked to show a passport going to different parts of what they see as their own country.
So look what's happening.
Not wear that.
Look what's happening now, Pat. You have a thing called Operation Sonnet, right? Operation Sonnet is this. It's actually window dressing by the government in terms of the border north south. So what they do now at the moment, when a bus comes from Newry into Dundalk, they check the bus. They take the people off that bus and they return them to Newry or to Belfast, where they get a taxi back to the south of Ireland. And, you know, we had last year 11 of days where those checks were in place, 10 this year where those checks are in place. It's absolutely laughable. Remember as well, when I asked Minister McEntee how many people were coming from the north of Ireland into the south of Ireland, she did not know for 2 years. And I asked her, why didn't she know? And she stated in the parliamentary questions because she doesn't ask the question. When I asked Minister McEntee how many people are going missing from the asylum process, she said she didn't know because there's no way of collating that information. When I asked Minister McEntee how many people are being smuggled into the country in terms of containers and trucks, this happened after the 14 people were found in a container in Rosslare. The minister said she doesn't know how many checks are actually happening on trucks. What we're having at the moment is a government who are snoring at the wheel in terms of this particular issue. And all we're saying in Aintu is we want a system that differentiates between those who need help and those who don't need help.
I mean, in theory, what you're saying is you actually find the people who need help and they get asylum wherever they land.
And strictly. And in those scenarios, what happens in that scenario is you reduce significantly the cost on the state in the whole process.
Okay, but how do you get to that point? How do you negotiate to that point with your brethren in Westminster and Belfast?
Well, the first thing to do is to open up the conversations. Now, the fact is that everybody has understood that this is the only logical way to deal with the movement of goods. The European Union wouldn't allow any other way. They just wouldn't. So what we need to do is sit down with our British counterparts, have that discussion. Right now, the government is refusing to do that.
Okay, now, a lot of proposals and costings in your manifesto, but adding up the proposals for home, refurbishment grants, Operation Shamrock, zero rate, VAT rate on electricity, reduced rate for the hospitality sector, we're at 2 billion. Looking for the cost savings in your manifesto, 30 million from the health service saved. Where's the rest coming from?
I will
from?
Say, first of all, in the last 10 years, the government spent 2.5 billion euros in compensation within the health service, which is an incredible thing. Last year, there were 107 adverse incidents. 500 people lost their lives in the health service last year because of mistakes that happened. So we want to make sure that we significantly reduce the level of mistakes happening in the health service by making sure it's staffed properly. Also in the health service, and this is a big reform that we're looking for of the health service, Pat. We're looking for a system whereby hospitals get paid for the operations, the treatments and the consultations they deliver.
You're talking about the money following the patient.
The money has to go straight to the patient. And that will mean that we won't get the money getting caught up with middle management and middle administration. And that's what's currently happening now. Right now in this winter, we'll have some hospitals that will close theatres because they'll be dealing with certain pressures within the system. But if you're only getting paid by the number of operations that are happening, you're not going to let that money go in middle management. You'll make sure that it goes to the nurses and doctors.
Okay, I want to move on because we don't have that much time, but social issues, and we're going to start with porn. You would ban children from accessing hardcore porn. That's in your manifesto. How?
Yeah, so for example, in other European countries such as France, they've started a system whereby that if a person wants to access hardcore violent pornography, and that there has to be some age verification in relation to that. So right now we know that hardcore violent pornography is having a significant effect on the minds of young boys especially. It's increasing the level of sexual violence against women. There's actually a big spike in sexual violence by children on children at the moment. And the government, you know, are shrugging their shoulders in relation to this. We have a system whereby internet service providers who provide the internet to your home, if they are providing a content that is providing this material to a child, that they don't allow for checks, that the government can go to them and say, listen, you need to stop this particular website having access to the Irish market through that internet service provider. It already happens in relation to counterfeit films, etc. Those ISPs are forced to close down the website that are providing counterfeit films.
Okay, so you need, therefore, to control the providers. That's
yeah,
that's
so basically, like if I'm selling a kid a bottle of vodka, I need to check the age of, it's my responsibility to check the age of the kids and consuming it. If there's hardcore violent pornography with showing violence against women and we're giving it to a 10-year-old, we need to check the age of,
now,
of
you the also want to ensure that SBHE materials are appropriate to the ethos of the school. So what are your concerns there? What's going on at the moment that you don't like?
Yeah, so over the last number of years, the government has introduced a number of new curriculum. And in these curriculums, for example, they have introduced issues such as, let's say, gender ideology and issues around pornography and many, I suppose, policies which do not have an ethos, if you like. And what I'm saying is that parents are employing the Department of Education to teach their children. The Department of Education should be listening to the parents of...
Do you think that kids should be, in SBHE, be taught about gender identity?
That absolutely. We're saying that the education should be fully based in science, etc. But, you know, I don't believe, for example, that a man can have a baby, for example. And, you know, I don't believe that we should get rid of the words mother and father. Like, right now in the curriculum, teachers are being told not to use the words mother and father in their classroom because it's not fully... inclusive. There are situations, for example, within the HSE that the word woman has been taken out and a person with a cervix has been used. We even saw it in maternity legislation where the government wanted to get rid of the word woman in relation to maternity legislation. And all I'm saying is we're a pluralist party, Pat. We do believe that there are people with different value systems in the country. And we want a pluralist education system where a person is able to find a school that reflects their education ethos. And right now, unfortunately, the government is going down the route of enforcing a uniform system that's not science-based and making parents accept this for
their kids. I mean, there could be people who would set up schools that would have an ethos that would be reprehensible. For example, putting down girls, not giving girls the same break as they give the guys and all of that kind of
thing.
Yeah, well,
obviously, look, this is within reason and within the ethos of society. Like, we're not within the rules of... We have legislation in terms of equality gender equality in this country would have to apply in relation to that.
Now, you talk about the HSEs using terms like chest feeding rather than breastfeeding.
Yes.
But they use breastfeeding all the time. And chest feeding is a very particular thing. It's to do with people who can't lactate, for instance. They still hold the baby on their chest and they may use a feeding tube attached to the nipple in order to feed the baby. So it's a technical term rather than substitute term for breastfeeding.
It is, but I suppose they used, in terms of cervical check, and cervical cancer is an extremely important campaign because it's a very, very dangerous, you know, illness. In marketing materials used by the HSE, instead of using the word woman, they used a person with a cervix. They did so, they said, to make sure that men with a cervix felt included in relation to that particular campaign. I think that message in relation to cancer that women get in terms of cervical cancer is so important. We need to make sure that the message is crystal clear and it cannot be confused in relation to trying to bring in these gender battles in relation to that.
On gender identity, you would like to repeal the Gender Recognition Act, and you say it's to ensure that male-born sex offenders are not housed in women's prisons. But it would also mean nobody could self-determine their gender if they're transitioning.
Yeah, one of the problems I have with the Gender Recognition Act at the moment is that there's no gatekeeper to it. So in other words, anybody can actually get a gender certificate and change gender. And we have seen, unfortunately, some people who do not have gender dysphoria, but who are using the law, I believe, opportunistically to spend their time in a woman's prison rather than in a male's prison. So we had the shocking situation of Barbie Kardashian, a male-born sex offender who threatens to violently kill his mother, and sexually attack her and rape her as well. And this government put Barbie Kardashian into a woman's prison where he spent his time shouting obscenities at both.
He was in a segregation unit.
And at the very start, he could be heard by other female, by female prisoners. And actually, also, he's dealt with by female prison officers in relation to that. Now, he has been taken out of that, but it was only Aintu that actually raised that. And in any other country, Pat, that actually, you know, would be raised as a significant issue.
I believe he's in solitary confinement at the moment.
Yeah.
But that question of using one extreme example to generalise.
No, like I do believe that we should have a situation where we have women can compete, for example, in women-only sports. I think that's an important issue. I know Leo Varadkar castigated the Irish Rugby Federation in terms of its view that it allowed for women-only rugby. But, you know, there are... We're dealing with when women compete, they need a fair and even playing field. And when you have male-born athletes playing against them with bigger body mass, with larger lung capacity, etc., you know, that is very unfair on many women who take their sport very seriously and very professionally in relation to preparing for it. So I do think we need to get into a situation where, see, the limit to one person's rights, Pat, is where they negatively affect the limits of another person's rights. And now, we do have a situation where, unfortunately, many women feel that their rights are being infringed on by the legislation.
I want to bring you some of the questions and comments. If Pather actually thinks unionists will happily show their passports moving from one part of the UK to another, he's off his head, or he thinks we are.
Well, first of all, unionists said that they would not allow for an Irish sea border for goods. Unionists were forced to accept it. We cannot, like the DUP, are representative of about 2 or 3 or 4% of the population of Ireland. Are we going to defer to actually the control of our country and the ability to govern to one political party? Are we saying that they have a veto in relation to this, or are we saying that the democratically elected parties in Ireland and Britain cannot come to a decision in relation to protecting the integrity of our migration process?
I live in Pather's constituency, and although I agree with a lot of what he's saying, I am concerned about Aintu's relationship with the church and what their intentions are regarding church and state. Can you ask Pather to elaborate on this? That's from James.
Well, I have to say, this makes me laugh out loud, and I have to, because we are a pluralist Republican political party. We have a situation where we have members who are atheist, agnostic, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim. You know, we are probably representative of the whole country. We base our policies on science and evidence. We do have a moral compass.
Like, but women's bodily integrity and pro-choice, for example?
We fully support women's bodily integrity, but we do believe in the rights to life. And, you know, we do want a situation where, and we're saying the focus of this election for us is 85% of abortions that happen in the state are for socioeconomic reasons. We want to give every single mother in this country the economic confidence to be able to raise her child to the full potential. We want a situation where there should be nobody. Right now we have like...
Do you though support the existing jurisdiction where women can opt to have an abortion if they so choose? Now they could have many reasons. It could be fatal abnormalities. It could be the fact that they were raped by a family member. It can be all sorts of reasons. Do you accept that there's any circumstance?
Where I'm telling you is for the next 5 years, our objective is we believe in the protection of the 3-day wait because there are thousands of children alive today as a result of the 3-day wait. We do want to see full freedom of conscience for doctors and nurses and people working within the medical profession. We do believe there's an ethical conversation needed to be had in relation to people with disabilities. Some of the masters of the maternity hospitals are saying that 95% of the babies that are diagnosed, let's say, with Down syndrome in the womb at the moment are not making it to full term. We do as a country dress ourselves in the clothes of diversity. But what will it say about us, you know, if we get to a situation where 95% of people with disabilities do not make it to full term? We need to have a conversation in relation to that. But our major focus in relation to that is, first of all, to make sure that every mother in the country has the economic confidence to be able to raise her children. We want a second, an additional child benefit that's focused on the 100,000 children who are in poverty. We want a ban on evictions for mothers who are pregnant. We want a situation where that child benefit is brought into play for the 4th month of pregnancy onwards, because most of the costs happen. So what we're looking for is just practical common sense policies to actually help mothers actually have a choice.
That is the title you put on your manifesto. Patito being the leader of Aintu. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.